Hi, I'm Betty, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I really want to thank the committee for asking me to come and share. I know how much work goes into these things, and I very much appreciate it. And you know, it's so funny. I was thinking on Thursday. I don't know about you, but right before I'm supposed to go somewhere, I come up with every reason in the world why it's really inconvenient. And I just as soon stay home, and, you know, and what excuse can I come up with? So when I was asked to share, I mean, I'm coming from so far away. I was thinking, well, tell me when the meeting is, and I'll come to the convention as I usually do. And they're like, oh, no, we're going to get you a room. I was like, a room? Oh, no. I mean, oh, that's too much. But also, it's inconvenient. I have a puppy, and I have a special needs puppy, right? Okay. I adopted this puppy when he was 11 weeks old with the sole purpose of getting a normal dog at the end. No, not so much. This is a cat in a dog's body, totally terrified of everything. And so I've had to go to extraordinary lengths to make sure that when I leave, I have the right people there. Not any people, just the right people. He has to, you know, the real recovery, obviously. So Thursday night at 7:30, my dog sitter canceled. And then as I was going to bed, my toilet was running over. In true lesbian fashion, I had just recently redone the interior of the toilet and everything. So I open it up and I'm fiddling with it, and the water starts spurting into the air like, you know, a fountain. And I'm like, and I'm putting it down. Now, I have to tell you that growing up in an alcoholic family where rage was our first and favorite coping mechanism, that's usually where I go. I'm usually throwing things. I imagine, luckily I don't own a gun, but I, you know, I'm driving down the highway, I'm imagining ramming speed, boom, you know, when somebody's not getting out of my way. And Thursday night, I start laughing. You know, I start laughing. And I thought to myself, well, this is recovery. You know, as I'm mopping down the walls and whatever and figuring out how I can compromise. And I left the dog at home. I did a little bit of compromise. And, you know, if I have something that I've been able to take away from my years in Al-Anon, it's that anything worth doing is worth doing poorly. Because as a perfectionist, that never, ever was part of what I thought was acceptable behavior. I have a home group. It's the Saturday Morning Walteria group down in the South Bay. I have a sponsor. And I have a serenity date. It's April 13th of 1992. And I will tell you in a general way, you know, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now, which you can sort of, you know, I always think it's funny when we tell you what we were like, when actually you can sort of see it to a certain extent. But I grew up in Kansas, a little town called Atchison, Kansas, about 10,000 people, and my family was I like to call it eccentric. On my father's side, my grandfather owned the last brewery in Kansas before Prohibition. And on my mother's side, her father was one of the town drunks. You know, but he wasn't an alcoholic because he only drank beer, right? And I don't know about you, but I mean, we had very fine lines about this stuff. I didn't really realize it at the time, but classification was very important. And my early years, the other thing that it's important for you to know, my father, although he wasn't an alcoholic, he was a rager. And I don't know, some of it came, I think he came from a family, he was one of 13 kids. You can sort of get lost there. But he also was a prisoner of war in World War II. And he was in prison camp for 2.5 years. Combine that with a child of the Depression, and you have a very frightened guy, really. You know, very frightened guy. And you know, I sort of laugh, but if you look up in the dictionary, you know, post-traumatic stress, you'd see my father's picture there. You know, depressed, you know, whatever. But the way he expressed himself to the world was he was a jokester. You know, he was a trickster. He, when I was a kid, he used to send us to the store to buy candy with play money. You know, Monopoly money. Yeah. as a prisoner of war, he had lost all his teeth, you know, in prison camp, or, you know, when he came back. And so he had full dentures. And I remember as a kid of 4 or 5, and he'd take his dentures out, and I'm like, and he'd look at me and go, well, honey, why don't you try it? So I'm pulling on my teeth. You know, it's like, I always like to say I have a few trust issues, yeah, but I come by them honestly. You know, on the other hand, you know, one of the other things that I've heard here this weekend again and again is the deadly nature of alcoholism. But if I remember anything, it is that alcoholism is a family disease. And the alcoholic is killing themselves in a very public and obvious way, but the Al-Anons are killing themselves just the same. My mom was the daughter of a very bad alcoholic. I mean, you know, the stories that I get of my grandfather and grandmother's interactions. My grandmother was this beloved, you know, if you cast a movie of Midwest farmer's wife, this, you know, my grandmother would have been it. She was sort of heavy and jolly, and she baked, and she played the piano, and like all that stuff that's just so wonderful. And my grandfather, you know, just drank it, drank, almost lost the farm. But he didn't drink on Sundays. The bar that he went to was closed. And so we got a picture of my grandfather on Sundays. And he was a really sweet guy. But he would do things like, you know, take my grandmother out to the cemetery to decorate the graves. That's the way we used to call it in Kansas, you know, put flowers on the graves. And one year he went out and drove up over a tombstone. You know, it was like the car is like this. You know, he had the typical alcoholic car. You know, it was like this door was different color than that door, and, you know, you just didn't know. But that was sort of, you know, it's hard for you, maybe if you didn't grow up in a place like this, but the farm was 2 miles away. So that was a long way away. You know, that was night and day. But when I was 6 years old, my grandmother died, and my life really changed at that point. Because my grandfather basically began to live with us. And as he moved, he didn't sleep with us, but he would go down. This was the routine. He would get up, he would go down to the bar, he would be at the bar the whole day, and then he would come back to our house for dinner. And he was not a quiet drunk. He was not a clean drunk. I always like to say I think my mother invented aromatherapy. We would always have candles, you know, at the dinner table, because my grandfather just stank. You know, he stank of stale booze, stale pants, you know, the whole thing. And my father, being a rager, you can imagine how this is going to work out. You know, he would explode, and so there was this constant battle all the time. And I, you know, what I learned to do was to run, to escape. You know, I would grab my bottle, which was Coca-Cola, and my plate of food, and I would run to the basement and watch television. You know, that was for me the quiet place, because my grandfather's up there arguing with the television set. My father's yelling at my grandfather. My mother's yelling at my father. And, you know, and then it will all come out sideways. You know, I was not an easy kid. You know, this is the other thing, is that I was a kid who needed a program at the age of 6, you know, clearly. And my father and mother's responses, if you think about it, they had no tools. They didn't grow up in families that knew what they were doing. So my father would whip off his belt, and, you know, he would chase, and I'd run around my mom. You know, and we'd be doing this literally in the house. And then when my mom would get upset, she would reach for the fly swatter. Oh, you know, ooh, the back of your legs with a fly swatter, ooh, that's not fun at all. But I wasn't the kind of kid that knew how to, you know, diffuse a situation. I was the one who was throwing gasoline on the fire, right? I never cried. And I've heard this the whole weekend. I was so not in touch with my emotions as a kid. I remember when they told me that my other grandmother, my father's mother, had died, I laughed. I wasn't trying to be disrespectful, but that was the only safe emotion I knew. I didn't know how I was supposed to feel or how I was supposed to act. So, you know, there I was, this kid that, and the other thing is that I've heard a lot of our stories this weekend that, I always felt different, you know. I always felt different, and I was different. I grew up with crossed eyes, you know, children can be so kind that you know, I was teased a lot. And what that did also was I had my fists up. Stay away, you know. You're going to hurt me, so I'm going to keep you away, so you're not going to hurt me. In school, I was the jokester, you know. How do I get attention? How do I get you to like me? You know, I'm going to tell the jokes. I'm going to be the smart ass. I'm going to be the one that's always in trouble. I remember I went to Catholic schools, of course, you know, Catholic, Irish. The family is Irish, German, and Dutch, which I always say is like it produces angry, stubborn drunks, right? You know, it's a perfect combination. I remember the nuns finally got so upset with the bad activities or the bad behavior in class. They split the class and put all the boys on one side and all the girls on the other. And they put me on the boys' side, which I said was sort of prescient, but, it's like, I thought it was great because I get to be over with all my buddies and, you know, just create more hell. When my grandmother died and my grandfather came to visit, my mother's untreated Al-Anonism really began to, flower. My mom, went into, I don't know what to say, how to say it. I mean, we were in a town with no mental health facilities, no mental health support at all. So was it just early menopause? Was it early menopause and a nervous breakdown? Was it, you know, depression, nervous breakdown, early menopause, and, you know, social anxiety disorder? Who knows? But it manifested itself in a lot of ways. You know, my mom began self-medicating with Mogan David wine. Okay, I always like to say there are no Jews in Kansas, but I knew what a Seder looked like because it's right there, or Shabbat because it's right there on the bottle of Mogan David wine, and she would keep 5 gallons under the kitchen cabinet and a little jelly jar that was always filled. You know, the doctors, she did go to some doctors because they gave her, you know, every pill known to man. You know, she slept with Prince Valium at night. And that was, you know, when you combine the Valium and whatever else they had her on and the Mogan David wine, to a great extent, she became sort of a zombie, a very angry and reactive zombie, but sort of a zombie. And I'm the youngest of 5 kids, and my older sisters and brother are 4 and 4 years, good Catholics, you know. So, and then there's a gap of 5 years. So I was mom's mascot, you know. I mean, everybody used to joke, but you know, as soon as I heard, you know, I was like the dog in the family, really. As soon as I heard the keys jingle, I'm like, where are we going? Gotta go. Well, can I go through? And I remember somewhat having some of these conscious ideas, but it was my job to watch out for her, you know, because she was crazy. You know, she was crazy. And she needed somebody to be with her. She, the other thing that I remember about my mom at this, during this time, is that the disease of alcoholism was showing not just internally, not just in the mental illness, but it was breaking out on her body. She had eczema and psoriasis so bad. I mean, her hands had bleeding cracks. It was as if she was wearing, like, catcher's gloves. And, you know, she would always be slathering stuff on. And it just, when I look back on it, the pain of that, and you know, on her feet and her hands in particular. I've inherited some of this bad skin, thanks, Mom. But mine is not like that. You know, mine's not like that because my life is not like that. You know, my siblings were getting into the teenage years. We were all bad kids. We were all crazy. I remember, I've said, and part of the thing too is that my dad, just to sort of go back, you know, my dad, in addition to being this jokester and trickster, he was also suffering from his own level of depression. He would stay up till 2 or 3, 4 in the morning, and then he'd sleep till like 12 or 1, and then he would go to work. He had his own place, the place. You know, he had a, he was a business machines, you know, typewriters, ad machines, whatever. So, you know, constantly people would be calling the house, is Bill there? You know, and he would always want us to lie for him. I would never lie for him. I would say, he said to tell you he's not here, you know. Very helpful child. Yeah, exactly. My mom's like, yeah. You know, you know, so, and you know, when I'd be down in the basement watching TV with him, he'd start snoring. I'd turn off all the lights and go upstairs. So, you know, I was not a perfect child either. But, you know, you've got this situation at home where you've got this volatile powder keg. My mother would always know just how to set it off. She'd like, you know, did you bring the milk home? No, I'll get it tomorrow. Did you bring the milk home? Where's the milk? Did you bring it home? God damn, I told you I didn't bring the milk home. I told you. And then she'd be like, oh, honey, shh, 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 shh. Because the explosion had happened. And as kids, we had certain windows. We were responsible to run and shut. Mother would go, shut the windows. And we'd all go run, you know, shut the windows so the neighbors wouldn't hear. You know, I mean, the neighbors knew exactly what was going on. I mean, where else was a guy out mowing the lawn at midnight, you know, with a flashlight? You know. My neighbor's mother-in-law was there one night, and she woke up her son-in-law and said, there's something going on at the Haglunds. They must have an emergency. All the lights are on. He said, oh, for God's sakes, just go to bed. You know, I mean, that was the insanity that we grew up with. And so my dad, if we had lived only on my dad's income, we would have been probably in poverty, you know. But this is where, you know, I love Al-Anons. My mom made us a middle-class family. You know, she dragged antiques out of the farm. She got them reupholstered. You know, she and my dad, you know, refinished all of the woodworking there in the home and all this stuff, you know, to make the home, to make it available for us. She knew how important education had been to her. She was a college graduate in the 30s. She was a musician. She was a fabulous musician. She could sit and play the American Songbook for like hours. You know, until my grandmother died, she was a wonderful singer. And isn't this amazing, you know, when you think about it? She lost her voice when her mother died. She lost her voice. I heard there was somebody in my town who sang in the church choir, and I was sitting with my grandfather one Christmas Eve, and he looked and he said, well, that's the old timer. He called my mother the old timer. You can imagine where that came from. And it wasn't her. It was this young woman who had been in my mom's choir. But it gave me a little idea of what my mom had sounded like. So, I mean, you know, it's like we're not stupid people. We're not flawed, you know, we're broken people, you know. Here's this woman with, you know, five kids, a raging mental illness, untreated Al-Anon, no tools, and what's she going to do? You know, what's she going to do? You know, and from my point of view, there was never any, I couldn't count on anything. You know, I couldn't count on anything or anybody. You know, my dad, I remember my mom was teaching preschool, and it was my dad's job to get me to my grandmother's to watch me. And I remember being all in my snowsuit waiting to go to get to grandma's, and mom came back from work before he had gotten me out the door, you know, which was sort of typical. And I just had a meltdown, you know. I'm like, because I wanted what I wanted, and I wanted to know that I could count on them, and I wanted to be able to do what, you know, you told me I was going to get to do this, and not in that family, you know, not in that family. So, you know, when I look from that point forward, you know, all of my really important relationships have been with alcoholics. You know, my best friend, after Catholic grade school, it was sort of a mutual decision. The nuns invited me to go elsewhere, and I thought it was a good idea. And so I went to the public high school, and the woman who became my locker partner, I played French horn in the band. You know, it was like I had this really split life where I had all these really loser, scuzzy friends, and then I also was in the plays, and I was, you know, I was first chair in the, you know, French horn in the orchestra, and I was in the National Honor Society. I did all this stuff because it never was enough. You know, I'm trying to get approval from, you know, from mom and dad in a situation where, you know, my mom, it was never enough. I remember bringing home report cards, you know, as a kid, and I would have straight A's. But then she would look over, and, you know, if I had straight A's, she would look over and see what the deportment side said, you know, which was never good. You know, if for whatever reason I managed to sort of get that in order, she'd look over and there would be a B. And that was not okay. You know, so I grew up just, you know, the idea of unconditional love was just not something that was in our vocabulary. Because I don't think nobody knew how to do it. Nobody got those tools. It was just not part of our DNA. And so when I, you know, my best friend in high school, I used to love hanging over at her house. Her parents worked together. I thought this was the coolest thing in the world. I was like, man, what would it be like to have a mom and dad who loved each other so much? They work together. They're with each other. They're, you know, going together. Wow, what a great thing. He ran a shoe shop. And I don't know, like 10 years later, I learned that her father was a horrible, raging drunk. And her mother worked at the shoe shop to keep an eye on him. It's like, you know. So, you know, that's the other thing that I have found that I think is so true is, you know, alcoholism, the family disease, is a disease of perception. You know, it colors my perception of reality. You know, I don't see things the way normal people see them. You know, if you treat me normally, if you treat me just, you know, like a routine, normal person, I feel less than. I feel like you've slighted me. I feel like you've insulted me. You have to treat me extraordinarily for me to feel normal, you know, because it's never enough. It's never enough. And, you know, and the other thing that, you know, as I talk about this crazy family, there was also a deep faith, you know, that was, or a deep religious practice. I'm not sure how I saw that as faith. But, you know, everybody went to church. We had a faith, you know, we prayed, all this stuff. But I didn't feel a connection to a power greater than myself at all. I like to say that if I had a power greater than myself before I came to program, you know, it was what you thought of me. because I turned my will and life over to the care of what you thought of me. You know, I was a chameleon. If you needed me to be in the band, I was going to be in the band. If you needed me to be, you know, the telling the jokes, I would tell the jokes. If you needed me to be, you know, watching my mom, walking with her, taking care of her, you know, that's what I would do. And in high school, you know, in high school, I'll just tell this one little story about mom, because it was very confusing to me about her, you know, drinking the Smoking David wine and using these drugs and stuff. You know, it was really confusing to me that whether she was an alcoholic or not, or whether, you know, whether she needed a program or not. I mean, I knew she needed a program, but whether she needed the, I love this, I heard this week, whether she needed the beverage program. I was like in senior high school, and I came in to tell her I was leaving for band practice or whatever. And she was asleep on her bed, and or at least I thought, and I was like, I'm leaving. And there was like no response at all. I was like, I'm leaving. I went over, no response at all. And I start shaking her, and she is, she wasn't dead, but she was as dead as you could imagine, because she was totally overdosed in some fashion. And it took about probably a good 2 minutes of shaking her to sort of get her conscious. And I just was like, I don't know what's going on, but this has got to stop. You know, I don't, you know, you got to get some help. I don't know what is happening here. The reason I know she doesn't belong in the other program is that she did. You know, it's like, I think she went back to the doctor. She either cut down or stopped taking whatever it was she was taking. And that probably 8-year saga of really horrible mental craziness passed. You know, she could have a half of a highball. They called them highball. She could have a half of a highball, and it would not, you know, it wouldn't affect her. And so it was like, it's just important for me to remember that I don't always know what is going on with somebody. I don't always know what the solutions are for anybody. And sometimes things aren't always what they look like, you know? You know, this friend of mine, she that I talked about, she and I became locker partners. We became, we went to the same college. We were roommates. Of course, only in later years did I realize how much in love I was with her. But, you know, that was not to be expressed at that time. You know, growing up in the Midwest in the 60s and 70s, you know, I look back at the family photos. I'm always carrying a rifle, you know, or I'm in a cowboy hat with, you know, six shooters, you know. I'm not really sure how anybody missed it, but and here's the other thing for me, you know, as I talk about that it was never enough, I was never enough for myself either. When I was a kid, if I had a dream, I would say that it was I wanted to be a doctor. You know, I don't know why. Maybe it was they had good TV shows on and it looked like, you know, they were helping people, saving people. It was that, you know. But I didn't tell anybody, really, you know, because if you actually told somebody what your dreams were, I mean, you know, oh my God, then what would happen if you didn't fulfill them? Then what would you think of me, right? So I went to college, and I my first semester of college, I took a biology course. And I remember coming back at Christmas time to get my grades, and I opened it up and I looked down and I had gotten a B in biology. Now, a normal kid would probably say, well, okay, you probably need to study, you know, study harder, maybe get a tutor, maybe, you know, not me. I looked at that and said, well, obviously, I can't do that, right? If I can't do it perfectly, and if it isn't easy, I don't want any part of it, you know? And so there goes this dream, the one dream I really had was just poof, out the window. My neighbor in the dorm was taking advertising classes in the School of Journalism, and I was reading her reporting books, and I was like, oh, that seems sort of interesting. So I ended up in the J School. It wasn't my dream, it was her dream, you know, but I borrowed it. And it turned out pretty fun. It was a great place to be. It was good. You know, 4 years later, you know, people were deciding on, you know, getting jobs and stuff like that. It seemed sort of drastic to me at the time. So literally, there were two guys who were working on the college paper, and they had an extra application to the law school admission test. They had an extra application, you know, sitting on the desk. And I said, oh, that sounds sort of interesting. I signed up. I ended up going to law school. I mean, wasn't my dream. Just, I gave more thought to, you know, what I was going to put on that morning to wear than what I was going to do with the rest of my life. You know, again, I think part of it is that I just never stopped to think what is, I think one of our speakers this weekend was talking about, I never thought to think about what is it that I enjoy. You know, what is it that I deserve? What is it that makes me feel good? You know, it's more like, what can I do to make my parents happy? What can I do to make you happy? What can I do to look okay so you will approve of me so that I don't have to feel like I've got to go and hide myself under the covers every day? You know, I went back. And again, you know, I went to law school, and I started work in an Irish Catholic law firm where they had happy hours every night. And, you know, and here's the, here again, you know, how does this happen? My brother ran into an old high school friend of his in a bar in Kansas City who was dating the daughter of the Irish Catholic law firm's partner and said, you should look up my sister. She's looking for a job, right? So, you know, that's how I ended up in that law firm, and that's where I stayed for 20 years. You know, that's the thing. You know, there are coincidences and there are God shots, but it's like, you know, if I get somewhere, I get real comfortable. You know, I'm not a runner. I sort of land in cement. You know, I'm like, like, okay, grow around me. You know, it's just too much trouble to, you know, to go look for something else, you know. And, you know, that whole situation, again, I am competitive. Because I don't really like myself completely, you know, I always measure myself against you. And I love being number two. I love being the assistant, blah, the co-chair, the, you know, the second in command. Because I can do whatever I want, make myself look really good, and throw pot shots at you. You know, gossip and complain and, you know, if so-and-so was doing their job, I wouldn't have to be doing this. But, you know, the martyr, right? Oh, poor, you know. And I had a competitor there at the firm. He was a guy, was about my same, he was like about a year more at the firm than I was. And he was a very open, active alcoholic. And, you know, it became very easy for me to try to figure out what was wrong with him, to try to help figure out what the solution should be for him. You know, not about myself, but it was always, how can I get you fixed? Because if I'm focused on you, I don't have to think about me. I don't have to think about, what are my defects? What am I doing? What am I doing with my life? Because my life is not going anywhere fast, you know. I came to program finally, like in 1985, 85, 86, when I was invited by a group of friends to go to a conference called Sessions by the Sea, down in Ocean City, Maryland. And, you know, I remember I was in this car at this conference, and this guy leaned his face in the car and said hello. And the person who was driving told me, "Oh yeah, that's Brooke. He's from a really wealthy family, and he's doing all the cooking, and he's doing the DJing for the dances, and he has all the music here, and he's a real fun guy. You should get to know him." I was like, "Oh." Now, I need to just say, I could probably count the number of dates I had, like on like one or two hands. And there was this piece of me that was always like, what's the matter with me? You know, what's the matter with me? But I never really wanted the answer to that, because that would have been really scary. You know, I just knew that I was not attracted to or not attractive to guys, which makes a lot of sense now. And this guy, put on the classic the classic Rush, you know. We went jet skiing, we went, you know, on the rides at the boardwalk. In fact, he did all the cooking. He drove a Saab convertible, not a convertible, but a Saab Turbo back in the time. That was a very hot car. He was wealthy. Did I mention he was wealthy? And we came back from there, and he sent me one rose the first day we were back, two roses the second day, three roses the third. Yeah, I mean, just really. I mean, like, you would probably fall for me if I was doing that to you, right? I mean, it was just like, oh, my God. And I was just blown away. Now, I didn't really think about the fact. Now, he was sober at the time. He claimed sobriety at the time. He had been trained as a counselor at Hazelden. He was treasurer of the area, you know, WAIA in DC, which is like the area intergroup. He wasn't working. You know, he had had a bad back. You know, he had injured himself at work, so he was on workers' comp, and he was a Dilaudid addict, and he did have, like, you know, have to go in the hospital at least two or three times a year, because he would do things like resod the backyard and then, you know, be in the hospital to need to get the drugs. He turned out, of course, to be like a sociopath, and I was gay, but so it was a marriage made in heaven, you know? It's, you know, I mean, doesn't everybody, like, before you take your vows, isn't everybody in couples therapy, sex therapy, and individual therapy? I mean, that's just normal, right? You know? Most places don't quite get this, but, you know, the other part of this that was really telling was, because of the back injury, he was impotent. So it really was a good deal for me. It's like, we sort of had one encounter, like, early on, and as soon as I moved in with him, like, we never had sex again. Which I knew wasn't normal, you know, but there was a part of me that was like, this is good, you know. So, you know, and I would love to tell you that this, you know, this only lasted a couple months. No. This lasted like 4 years. It was 4 years. And, you know, there was a sense of isolation. There was a sense of embarrassment. And I started going to Al-Anon, you know, at the urging of my friends. I started auditing Al-Anon during this period of time. I think I also was, you know, it was the 80s. I was beginning to sort of see that, you know, my family situation had not been normal. You know, 5 minutes? Oh, dear. So, you know, what I found was that it was so important for me to just to go and try to find my people. But I, you know, I would go into these rooms of these, you know, blue-haired ladies, and I would talk about, you know, my going to sex therapy with the guy who was a Dilaudid addict, and I remember them just sort of having these blank faces, you know. And I wanted to blame them, you know. It's like, well, what's, where is this, we're going to love you till you love yourself? Yeah, I didn't feel it. I didn't feel it at all, you know. But I wasn't giving them a chance, you know. I remember the complete struggle. And, you know, we were totally isolated. And I felt like crap. I felt like crap because I didn't see any answers. I didn't see any way out. Of course, when I moved into this house, it was a house that had been owned by his aunt, and she gave it to us for a wedding present. So I got rid of all of my stuff. I mean, what do I need my stuff for, right? I mean, I'm living in this 80-year-old woman's house. It was all pink. Oh, my God, it was horrible. But, you know, but it was very expensive, and it was very nice, and it was big, and, it, you know, We had dogs at the time. I should have known when my oldest dog started growling when he would come home that there was something wrong, right? Your dogs usually should pay attention to your dogs, right? And the other thing was, is that, you know, I started noticing that we had the best high-tech digital video equipment in the world and suitcases that were like under the beds and stuff, you know, porn, you know, and there was one night that there was a city paper that was open next to the phone, and I saw it was open to this, you know, Asian women, whatever. And I was like, huh, that's curious. And I pick up the phone and I hit memory redial because the last call I had made was to my sponsor, she wasn't a sponsor at the time. And I get this Asian woman's voice, you know, hey, you want, I'm like, what the? You know, and I went in and I confronted him, and I was like, what's going on, you know? And he comes running into he's in his tidy whities, and he comes running into the den. He's like, I'm so tired of your suspicion, with his finger in my face. And I had a moment of clarity. I was like, it ain't suspicion. You know, it was like for the first time in my life, I looked at him and I was like, I'm not the one who's crazy, he is, you know? I'm not the one, you know, and I knew at that point, I remember going in the bathroom and looking at myself and going, you know, I know what I want in my life is to have a, you know, family and to have a loving relationship. And I know, the only thing I know is that I'm not going to get it here. You know, I'm not going to get it here. And so luckily one of my friends was dating a mover at the time. They came and picked me up the next day. We lived next door to his parents. It's way too long of a story of dysfunction and, oh my God. So he came home in the middle of it and tried to keep the dogs, and it was just a big mess. But I went to my first Al-Anon meeting that night, in Alexandria, Virginia. It was April 13th of 1992. And I began my journey then. You know, and my journey has been one of discovery. It's been one of recovery, you know, where it has been a lot about, you know, working the steps, having a sponsor, sponsoring people. It's been about accepting myself as I am on life's terms. You know, accepting life on life's terms, but first accepting myself on life's terms. You know, I'm never enough. I never have enough people. I never have enough money. I never have enough anything. And yet what's happened is by working these steps, it's sanded off some of those rough edges. You know, my job was everything to me. That's how I moved to California. I moved to California for a job, and then big giant company merged with another one, and I went to a big giant law firm where I had a big giant, you know, corner office with the glass windows, and that defined me for a long time. And then I lost that job, and I had a period of unemployment and struggling for employment for about 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And I, you know, I went to real depths at that point, because what else do I have? You know, what else do I have? And what I had to do was really learn to take direction, really ask for help. You know, I went to a friend of ours from our home group, came up to me and said, I'm going to help you. You know, like, and he didn't have to add whether you like it or not, you know, but I'm going to help you. And I started going and having coffee with this guy. And he is the most connected. He's one of us, you know, good friend of Dorothy and so well connected. And he kept looking at me going, I see you doing HR. You need to do HR. And I'm like, what do you mean HR? The next thing I know, he has me meeting in Hollywood at the Hollywood Works and, you know, where he's got me signed up for an HR management course at Cal State Dominguez Hills. I'm like, are you crazy? Are you what? But my mouth says, okay. You know, I don't have any better ideas. So I go and I do this. The last week of that class, I'm looking in the paper, I see these two different ads for, and I'll wrap up with this story. I saw these two different ads for temp jobs. One was, you know, downtown LA, corporate, pretty good money. The other was like a very far away from where I live at the beach, suburb, nonprofit. And I'm like, well, yeah, I don't really want to do that. So I applied for the downtown job. They called me the next day and said, that job has been filled. But we have this nonprofit job in this far suburb. And I remember I was holding the phone and I looked up at the ceiling. It was like that funny God, right? So I went to this temp job. It's an international humanitarian organization where we fight for justice and poverty. We fight just for justice and against poverty around the world, primarily for kids. I started off as a fill-in for somebody out on maternity leave, and it became a full-time job last September. It's a faith-based organization, which freaked the hell out of me because I'm like, my first day, they pray together in the mornings. My first day there, I was sitting at my desk praying about whether I should join them in prayer. And I did. And you know what we pray for? I get paid every morning to pray for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. I would have missed it all. I would have missed it all. I now get to be useful. I knew that I could be useful and of service in these rooms. I knew that I could hold my hand out. I am responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches their hand out, I want the hand of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. But I now get to practice these principles in all my affairs where I never thought it possible. All because I let you help me when I didn't want it, when I didn't think I needed it, and when I didn't know what it could bring. My trust issues are getting better. They're not perfect, but they're getting better because of you all. And I thank you for my life.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.